It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Long Road to Ruin. I am your special guest, interim managing supervisor, host, I don't know, throwing you various titles there. I'm Robert Winfrey. Co-founder and normal host Mark Radulich is firmly entrenched in the Jonas Exodus, and we wish him well. Godspeed, Mark. But for the next couple of months, since we didn't want the Long Road to Ruin to go back on hiatus, and man, we just got Sean Comer back, so you know what? We're pushing through. So I'm here. I'm Robert Winfrey. Thank you all for being here as well. And I just mentioned him, but he's here as well. He fought through Phoenix traffic and being an hour off because Arizona doesn't recognize daylight savings time. Sean Comer is here, folks. Sean, you're still with us. You didn't go on another hiatus between last show and this one.
Top, blow me, stuck in traffic land. 0 out of 10, would not visit again. Anyway.
I'm with you.
Anyway, yes, folks, I'm Sean, you're not, and this week's show is brought to you in loving memory of the past 72 hours' tragic losses combined of John Pinette, Mickey Rooney, and now, as of today, Harvey Korman.
Really?
So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Rough week.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm now thinking of what I wish had happened on Sunday instead of what did. WrestleMania Sunday, throughout the course of the day, stand-up comic John Pinette was found dead in his hotel room at age 50. For those of you who aren't familiar with his comedy itself, the movie I remembered him in most was for one thing, having a supporting role in Lionsgate's excellent The Punisher as Beppo, I think his name was.
I can look it up if you want.
Yeah, the big fat guy that shares the boarding house with Frank Castle and Rebecca Romijn Stamos' character's name and the weird guy with all the piercings. He was in that. He was also one of the dancing monks in Double Team. And, yeah, I haven't read anything about what his cause of death was, and I don't want to necessarily sound like I'm being presumptuous or judgmental, but John wasn't exactly a pack of peanuts, and about 99% of his stand-up was predicated on the ability to make people laugh with self-deprecating jokes about his weight. But still, a very funny guy, very talented guy, and unfortunately one that the comedy world has now lost too soon. Mickey Rooney, obviously, needs no introduction. 93 years old, at one point very legitimately the biggest star in Hollywood. Go ahead, make all the jokes. I'll sit here and have a soda while I wait. And just an icon whose time had come. He did all the living that he set out to do. And then today we learned that one of the great B grade or less movie directors of all time, Harvey Korman, has passed away. Another luminary in his own right, even if it is mostly in the realm of making schlock cinema, and mostly movies that were famous just for being out now, cult midnight movie, nothing else on the two favorites. So, rough week for entertainment. One of my Facebook friends said a little bit ago, said, we're only partway through the year, and if this is three, we're in trouble.
Yeah,
so,
it's kind of appropriate because here we are talking about, if you didn't recognize the music that I played there to go after our opening theme, that very famously is referred to as Hello Zep, which is the theme, more or less, for the Saw franchise. Now, that particular bit of music has actually been put with several other previews in the interim. I've heard it used in other locations, but that's where it started. And we are talking about Saw tonight. If you, again, didn't recognize the music, haven't read the descriptions or anything like that, And we're tackling, just for the purposes of disclosure, we're tackling the first three films here tonight, and then 2 weeks, we're coming back and we're doing the other four, and oh boy, I'm going to stay positive because I can be positive about these three, surprisingly so, depending on your perspective. The next four, I got some issues, and you'll hear about them in a couple of weeks. But, I actually found something interesting when doing some research for this. Surprise, I do research, folks. Doesn't always stick with me, and it's not always the most accurate, but I put forth a little bit of effort here. To kind of set this up, horror is very kind of a cyclical genre. You have high points and low points. It goes up and down, sometimes very steeply. But I bring this up because whenever I'm on, I seem to be kind of the go-to guy for various horror genres here, if Mark and Sean feel they need a third voice. When I was on about Scream, I brought up the same point got brought up. When I was on here talking about Paranormal Activity, the same point kind of got brought up. And that is, horror is, it goes up and down. And when it's down, it's pretty down. And then something new, different, whatever, comes along, and all of a sudden, bam, it smashes some conventions, it reintroduces things, and horror becomes profitable again. You get umpteen sequels because no one bothers to understand what actually made them work in the first place. This is the more dinosaur syndrome that I'm going to get into in further detail later. It goes downhill, something new comes along, and it's profitable again, and yay, everyone's happy. And Saw as a movie is actually, for a long time, was the most profitable horror film since the first Scream movie. And there was a fair amount of time in between their releases. So, Sean, I'm pretty sure you know a bit more about the backstory and the production of the first Saw movie than I do, so I'm going to let you kind of... You know, how did you get into this particular film, and you know, what knowledge do you have to bestow on all of us?
Oh, well, of course I know a little bit more. This is what you guys expect of me at this point. I didn't really necessarily come about it with anything much of a special story, except for the fact that it was making huge waves in terms of both reviews and box office. And one night, after it had already run its course through theaters, I was subscribed. I was still at Northwest Missouri State University, actually, way up in the far PFE northwest corner, just about southwest Iowa part of Missouri. And in my apartment after work one night, I was scrolling through a streaming video service that I had at the time that was kind of, sort of, a very, very early, mildly special needs rendition of Netflix, and was looking for something to watch, and I happened to come across it, not even realizing it was available for on-demand, and I decided, oh, why the hell not? I've been meaning to check this out for ages anyway. So I sat down, and for 2 hours, just with the lights off, sitting at my ancient, long-time-lost-now Dell desktop, just sat there absolutely transfixed by a movie that seemed to remember everything that works in horror that every other movie, with the exception of a scant few every year, seems to more or less just willfully ignore. Because that's the thing about horror, is what works in horror has, for a long time now, never really changed. It's just that despite it all being right there for the interpretation, right there for the application, just very, very plain, this will always get an audience's attention, it always seems to just be, well, what I just mentioned, willfully ignored in favor of, well, sadly enough, everything else that drags the remaining Saw sequels down after the third one. So that was my very first time sitting through it. And this was about, I think, oh, 2 or 3 months after it had been out of theaters. But actually, to be quite honest with you, I don't have a real interesting story behind how I came to the franchise. The really intriguing one is actually how the movie came about in the first place. And the thing you remember about a lot of great movies is that they didn't come directly from fully-fledged original scripts. They were adaptations of one thing or another. And sometimes they weren't even adaptations of something comparable in length, like a novel or perhaps a TV series. In this case, it was actually an adaptation of a 2003 9-minute short film that was written by a couple of then completely unknown writers named James Wan and Lee Whannell. It was direct, and of course Wan also directed it, but the thing is, those were the same people that took their short project and eventually adapted it into a full-length film. And sometimes this works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you get a 9-minute short film that's adapted into a full-length feature. Sometimes you get Daft Punk trying to take a music video and adapt it into an almost entirely dialogue and soundtrack-free 90-minute feature. That's just kind of awkward. It's kind of awkward and dull and not really fun to watch. But in this case, the short that they adapted was actually later added to, well, not even later, just kind of in the course of writing it, adapted right into the full-length feature as a very pivotal scene. And it's the scene that involves the interrogation of Dr. Gordon, played by Cary Elwes, and the recollection of Amanda, played by Shawnee Smith, of her own experience actually surviving one of Jigsaw's traps. It's the famous reverse bear trap scene. Except that in this one, we've originally got Lee Whannell, who also in the first movie would play, God, now I'm blanking on his character's name, Adam, who would play Adam, the other fellow that's locked in the bathroom with Dr. Gordon. Here, he is serving the role of, well, eventually, Amanda. And to be quite honest with you, the short and the scene in the movie are every ounce as effective as would be expected, since you've got all the exact same principles working on it, right down to also having the music in the short film provided by the great Charlie Clouser. So that made such a big buzz, and it went over so well at the Sundance Film Festival that it was just, that was what lit the candle. That was what strapped the rocket to their back. And from there, the rest, shall we say, is history.
Well, we'll have to see what James Wan does with the next Fast and the Furious movie, but
To this point,
he's nearly batting 1,000.
At this point, you know, I have nothing but faith in him because, as we'll explain as we go along, I don't want to sort of blow my load right on the spot here, talking about what the long-term significance of the movie and of the franchise has been. But really, James has only had one project that's truly flopped, and that was Dead Silence. And even James himself has admitted, yeah, I really would have been better off never even writing that. I was burned out, and I was just writing because I felt like I needed to be working on something. So he went ahead.
Learning experiences.
Yeah, but the other interesting thing is this. Keep in mind also that this short was made for $3,000 U.S., $5,000 Australian. So it's not like even this was necessarily a grandiose spec project.
Well, last I checked, the original conception of the short and kind of how the genesis of the story was they were film students, and they figured the cheapest film to shoot would be one involving two actors in a room.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. Usually it is.
Which is surprisingly close to what we get in the finished product, but... Now, you mentioned it did create a buzz at Sundance. This is a little bit more business side of things that I want to mention, but this was picked up for production, the original Saw movie, by Lionsgate Films. Films Entertainment, I don't know what they call this. Lionsgate. Yeah, everybody knows Lionsgate at this point in time. But prior to the first Saw movie, that was not the most vaunted of production houses. I believe their most commercially successful venture was Fahrenheit 9/11, which is like the Blair Witch Project of documentaries. Nothing's happening, nothing's happening, nothing's happening, nothing's happening. It's over, everyone looks pissed.
it's over the Republicans pissed, otherwise it's over the Democrats were asking for towels.
Yeah, but The point being, this was not the biggest studio in the world. Then they get a hold of the first Saw movie. It was made, it had a final budget of what, like somewhere between 1 and 1.2 million? And it made over 100 million worldwide. So, profit margins, folks. That's actually why they made so many of these movies. Because you could make them.
Robert?
Yeah.
You want a short list of what else they're responsible for?
Before or after?
Oh, just kind of a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B.
Yeah, sure, go for it. Because I know that, well, the only other one I know off the top of my head was I know they did the first, the Thomas Jane Punisher movie, which
I enjoyed, but
had plenty of problems.
Yeah, it had its problems, but, you know, it had its potential. I mean, he would have had a chance had the right people been on board, I think, and this is a discussion for another time, perhaps, but had the right people been on board for the Punisher Warzone that came after it, I really think that could have been the start of a great franchise. That's strictly my opinion. But again, we can talk about that another day. No, the Lionsgate name has actually been attached in some sense or another to, and again, sometimes this is distribution, sometimes it's just rights ownership. But again, these are other things that they've been involved with. Alf, The Dead Zone, The Dresden Files, Mad Men, Nurse Jackie, Weeds. That's all Lionsgate Television, of course. They have distributed the Clifford the Big Red Dog and Mattel's Barbie-branded videos from Scholastic and Stickin' Around. As of 2008, they own the distribution rights to According to Jim, Reaper, Hope and Faith, Eight Simple Rules, and Boy Meets World. Let's see. Through E, they are also partially responsible. Responsible meaning, in this case, to blame for. Kimura, Life in the Fab Lane, Sunset Tan, and Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
There are some people who I would really like to stick in a maze full of razor wire.
In partnership with HIT Entertainment, they have also had a hand in Barney and Friends, Bob the Builder, Fireman Sam, which sounds like a pet name for a penis, Fraggle Rock, Pingu, and Thomas the Tank Engine and Friends. Through Universal, we've got Boomtown, Little House on the Prairie, Saved by the Bell, Will and Grace. God, Lionsgate, get out of television. You've also been involved with Care Bears, Fifi and the Flower Tots, Miss Spider's Sunny Patch Friends, 1-800-MISSING, Power Rangers Super Samurai, okay, can't hate you for that one, Rory the Racing Car, Secret Diary of a Call Girl, Speed Racer, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and also Saw, See No Evil, The Hunger Games, and Twilight.
Yeah, that's a pretty diversified portfolio there.
I should point out, though, that's all Lionsgate Home Entertainment. That's a completely different branch from, well, it's a one arm of Lionsgate Entertainment. But still,
now my point with all of that was, and I've mentioned this before, Jigsaw built Lionsgate. That whole production house, where it is now, that foundation, that house, was built by Tobin Bell and Jigsaw. Much the same way that New Line was built by Robert Englund and Freddy Krueger. I mean,
I
New Line
here
was on the verge of bankruptcy.
I am hereby goddammit demanding that if they go through with the plans to make an 8 Saw movie that rebates
will want rebates.
I swear, the last two weeks, I am such the Artemist with my words of smart and funny making. I am demandimating that Lionsgate build the 8th Saw movie as being from the corporation that brought you Fireman Sam.
That would just be awesome. All right, now we've talked a little bit about kind of the business, the backstory. Now, for those of you who don't know, I'll give you a brief kind of rundown of the plot. We wake up with two guys, played by Cary Elwes and, oh, 1L, I can never remember his first name for some reason. They're locked in this horrifying industrial bathroom. And I mean horrifying, folks. This is the type of thing that will haunt your nightmares if you're Howie Mandel or vaguely germophobic. It's nasty. And they come to the realization that they've been placed here. They're chained across the room from each other. There's a dead guy in the middle of the room. They've been placed here by a serial killer known as Jigsaw. We get flashbacks. Gordon was at one point a suspect in the particular case. The great Danny Glover is the lead detective for a while. And they find hacksaws. They come to the conclusion that they're supposed to cut through their feet because their chains are of industrial strength stuff and the hacksaws can't get through them. The guy who we believe to be the Jigsaw killer for a good portion of this movie is actually Michael Emerson, pre-Lost. And he has Dr. Gordon's family, and he's telling him he has to kill Adam, and his family's going to die. Horror tropes ensue. We get some great sequences, and we're going to get into those in more detail. At the end of the film, Cary Elwes cuts his own foot off to escape. He shoots Adam through the shoulder. Michael Emerson shows up. He's going to kill Gordon because he took too long to kill Adam. Adam is not dead. He's just wounded. He then beats Michael Emerson to death with a toilet lid in an absolutely glorious sequence, by the way. Gordon crawls out of the room. We find out that actually Michael Emerson's character, known as Zepp, was being manipulated by Jigsaw, who at that point is revealed to be Tobin Bell, who was the man in the middle of this room, not actually dead the entire time. And he winds up locking Adam in this unholy bathroom to kind of conclude your big twist. And I hope I'm not leaving anything of substance out there. But there's your basic plot.
Well, it's Saw. It's pretty much a constantly complicated movie. So, yeah, it's one of those movies wherein if somebody asks you what it's about, you're really not going to do the movie justice at all with a summary like that. So I don't say that to diminish you or really bust your balls or anything.
Go for it.
No, but
I'm okay.
It's an impossibility. It's an exercise in futility to take the movie and just narrow it down to that. Especially the first movie, because the first movie is so thematically rich and character rich, and there are so many layers of both love and hate that you kind of engender for the characters along the way. This movie is not necessarily the guys in the white hats on one side, the guys in the black hats in the other one. I mean,
that's one of my favorite things about the movie. Throughout the first time I watched it, and you're trying to figure out who the killer is, everyone involved, everyone that you see prior to the reveal of who it actually is believable in the role of killer. It wouldn't shock you in the least if Cary Elwes drags himself out of that room and Adam pulls a key out and unlocks himself, and he was the one. It's just one of those things where everyone is believable to one degree or another as being the mastermind behind the whole thing. And that's a credit to the acting, so that everyone has just that little bit of slime to them that you're a little uneasy about them, and to the writing wherein everyone is potentially a suspect.
Well, not just that, but every single one of these outstanding performers, everything is played so believably. It's so easy to become immersed because the direction is really, and the performances are just pitch perfect with what you would really expect of someone under those actual circumstances as that time was wearing on and as those circumstances kept changing. It is, and God knows I'm probably going to engender some people who are really rolling their eyes at me as I'm about to say this, but quite frankly, I don't think Cary Elwes has ever delivered a better performance in his career than this movie. And, oh yes, go ahead, fire shots at me if you want to, kids. I'm counting the Princess Bride in that.
I was just going to say I thought his scumbag role in the live-action Jungle Book movie was just robbed at the Oscars.
Yeah, I can kind of see how you'd feel that way. But as far as being a truly grounded, dare I say even subtle, believable performance, for me, no, I know how much people love The Princess Bride and everything, and totally rightfully so. I'm right there with you on that. But as far as the best work Carrie has ever done, no, for me, it doesn't get better than this movie. Because you get to watch an otherwise very, very intelligent man whose career demands just perpetually cool nerves, who unravels practically from one minute and one twist to the next. Just a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And he never breaks down into that whole ridiculous kind of Kiefer Sutherland as Jack Bauer territory, where it's almost cartoonish because Kiefer is delivering every line like he's just finished running a marathon. And everything is either stage whispered through gritted teeth or bellowed like it's a goddamn Ultimate Warrior promo. You know, Kiefer has two gears. He can do one or the other, but there is really no slow ratchet up with someone like that. And many other actors are the same way.
Nicolas Cage comes to mind.
Yes, Nicolas Cage and Al Pacino both do that. They are either looking like they rolled out of bed onto the set 15 minutes ago, or like you are about to get 2 hours of loud noises.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, it's an interesting study because if you look at where he starts, well, you look at where Cary Elwes, his character, where he starts in the movie, he's one of the first voices you hear, and he's disembodied because you're looking at the other guy. God, I am blanking on names all night, folks.
Adam,
thank you.
Adam, who's Adam, played by co-writer Lee Whannell.
Lee, yeah. Okay, I'm going to remember this, I swear. But he's one of the first voices you hear. He's a little disembodied, but he's just ridiculously cool and intellectual, and he's looking at everything in their situation very logically. He's almost, I mean, disconnected to the point of he's more annoyed to be here than he believes he's in any legitimate peril, which fits with his character. And then at the end of the film, for him to just scream, pardon my language, folks, I'm not big on profanity, but for him to just grab the chains holding him to the pipe and go, fuck this shit, and proceed to saw off part of his own leg, and it makes sense. You know, you get there gradually, and it's believable all along the way.
So, and as much as I love Carrie, let's not sell Lee short either, because keep in mind, this is one of the co-creators of these characters, whose best friend and collaborator is behind the camera, and here's Lee in this unspeakably filthy, dingy bathroom, who is spending this movie, and yes, obviously I realize that this is not real poo he's dipping his arm into.
I don't know, they had a small budget, it might have been.
Yeah, for all we know, who is just dunking himself practically bicep deep into a toilet to try to reach around and pull a key out, who is throwing himself on the floor in mock convulsions as he's trying to imitate being electrocuted, all with this big-ass chain attached to his leg, who's just letting himself just absolutely look like he's gone to pot throughout the course of the shoot. And it's just, not only is he a trooper, not only is he enduring it, but for as much as Cary Elwes and Michael Emerson and Shawnee Smith and Tobin motherfucking Bell absolutely shine the brightest throughout this movie. And Danny Glover, of course. Danny Glover looking damn good, too.
He's still too old for this shit.
Yeah, still too old for this shit. And of course, I've also got to throw in Mackenzie Vega and Monica Potter. Fuck me, if you were on camera in this movie, just God bless you and hats off.
And we had a Benito Martinez sighting in this movie.
Yes, thank you. I almost forgot Benito Martinez, too.
He's there for one scene as Cary Elwes's lawyer, but hey, Benito Martinez.
But Lee really goes so above and beyond to sell this, and I don't think that's something that ever gets credit, because throughout the movie, he manages to convey slimy, somewhat funny, and as we wear on, and especially as we get toward the closing about 15 minutes of the movie, increasingly, convincingly desperate and angry and accusatory. It really is brilliant to the point that I would almost say, damn, it's a goddamn shame that you really haven't been in anything else that's been quite as well known as this.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
So, I mean, and hats off to both of them, because this is what I love about these kinds of limited scope movies, is it forces the filmmaker's hand. And especially when you're doing this with such a low budget as what this one had, or what something like, say, I don't know, Cube had, or Grave Encounters, or Resident Evil, the first one, or any other fairly low-budget movie that I've absolutely loved, is the fact that it forces you to get it with performances, careful shot selection, pacing, and being able to do what James Wan does, I believe, better than any other single filmmaker working in Hollywood today. He sets up the tension, and then he delivers on it and knows exactly when to move on from it. Not with a fake-out, not with a boo scare, not with cheap tactics or with painfully obvious special effects. He just simply honestly executes, and he does it again and again and again throughout this movie, and it keeps showing up even in the two movies after it that he collaborated on but didn't direct, which we'll get to. But that's one of the biggest reasons why this is the hallmark of the entire franchise. It's simply because it was the starting point. It was that first stride out of the gates for somebody whose name, I think, already less than a dozen films into his career, already, I think, is deserving of being mentioned alongside names like Clive Barker and Wes Craven and John Carpenter as one of the great masters of not just scaring people, but of horror filmmaking as a whole.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And there are some kind of funny stories that come out of this movie, and I'm going to tell you probably my favorite thing about this film, and there's plenty of things that I like about it, but I did not see this in theaters, not because I wasn't aware of it, but because I looked at what other people were saying about it, and the previews and everything, and my initial thought was, honestly, I don't feel compelled to watch 90 minutes of gore for the sake of gore, and I maintain that stance, which is one of the reasons I have never and will never bother with any of the Hostel movies. But that was my position.
We're trying to get to this sometime.
Hang on, I feel like getting to it now, because it's a point of what the others do that this one doesn't.
Go ahead. We talked about this, and you know full well that I couldn't possibly agree with you more.
Yeah, thank you. And my stepmother, hi Squeak, if you're listening, mentioned to me that I should see it because she thought it's something I would enjoy. And we tend to have similar tastes in that kind of vein, so I figured, all right, we rented it for a night, watched it at my dad's, and I just, to this day, still love this movie. Rewatching it in preparation for this was just an absolute joy because I got to look for other things, I got to notice other things. But one of the things that struck me after that whole movie was done, after I'd heard all the negative things that I had about it, one of the first things that came to my mind was, you know, that wasn't all that bloody. And I stand by that. Ladies and gentlemen, if you've seen this movie and you came away with the impression that it's just dripping with gore and violence and all that and et cetera, I defy you. I challenge you. Watch it again. Get a notebook and write down every time you see on camera an act of overt, graphic violence. Because I guarantee you that's a short list. Almost all of the violence and the stuff that's unsettling is not depicted on camera. It's implied, it's stated sometimes, we get hints of it, but they never show you necessarily. And as a literary or a film device, this allows you, the reader, viewer, the person experiencing it, your mind does the work for you. And 9 times out of 10, what you come up with in your own mind is worse than what you could put on film. It's a beautiful technique used as far back as, I want to say, The Cat People, something to that effect. An old black and white film, way back in the day. You let the audience do it to themselves, do it in their own mind, and you get better results than what you can show on camera. And I'm going to give you a quick example. The way in which the reverse bear trap destroys a styrofoam head as a demonstration to Amanda while she's strapped into one. The visualization, what you conjure in your head of what that would do to another human being, is exponentially worse than what we get on camera in the final movie when Jigsaw's ex-wife is put into one. And it actually kills someone for the first time in franchise history. Different, but the point there is, her getting out of it at the last second and it exploding and the styrofoam head being shredded and whatnot, that's worse. That is worse in your own mind than the CGI version we actually got. And I will argue with anyone vociferously, this is not a film that falls into the genre of what has been coined torture porn. Plenty of films do fall into that category. Plenty of them were inspired to one degree or another by this film, and I am very much disappointed that that has kind of become the lasting legacy of this film and this franchise in general. But this one doesn't fit that criteria, folks. Again, watch it again. Write down how many times you actually see something discussed. And don't get me wrong. They talk about it. I mean, the way they discuss what happened to the guy who had to crawl through the maze of razor wire. You combined some of the camera techniques wherein you get almost a fast-forward version and you have heard the police officers talking about how badly he was cut. You get the impression and your mind does the rest. They don't have to show you everything. And I find it to be so much more effective that way. And it's one of my substantial gripes with the later entries into this franchise that we will get to. But
Allow me to give you a little bit of a hand with a comparison here. Allow me to list for you all of the horrific acts of violence that are shown in their entirety in Saw. Detective Singh gets his head blown off with a shotgun. Several shotguns, in fact, and actually you never really see the head explode.
Nope.
It's shot very carefully so that you see plenty of blood, but you never actually get the brain go splody moment.
I mean, honestly, it's a bit more disturbing because they show you a couple of still shots that were presented as like black and white crime scene photographs.
Right.
They do frequently in this film, that method of filmmaking, which was actually a budgetary and a time concern. I interrupted you, but I'm just agreeing with your point there.
Yes, you did interrupt me.
Sorry,
I'll shut up. No worries. Detective Tapp gets his throat slit Assassin's Creed style. No, seriously, I'm not joking around here. I'm not making a clever euphemistic comparison.
A blade comes out of Jigsaw's robe.
Actually produces a fucking hidden blade, whips the thing around, and damn near turns Danny Glover into a Pez dispenser. In addition, we also have the wonderful, beautiful, just amazingly talented Shawnee Smith pulling the key to the reverse bear traps lock out of a sedated, paralyzed, she believed at the time dead human body. However, you never do exactly get to see her forearm deep in intestines.
And
again,
as a brief disclaimer, I timed it. You actually on screen see the intestines or the stomach going through her fingers for less than a combined total of 4 seconds.
Oh, yeah. It is extremely brief. Otherwise, you hear some squishy, squeaky sounds. And finally, you, of course, will see her hands caked in blood when she ultimately pulls the key out and gets it free. But, of course, since we affectionately like to call these three movies the Amanda Trilogy, she obviously gets the damn thing off her head. Toward the end of the movie, Carrie saws his foot off, but we never see him remove the foot.
You barely see him start to saw at it.
Unlike, say, two movies later, when in the exact same scenario, we see Mark Wahlberg I'm sorry, you're right, wishful thinking on my part. Donnie Wahlberg.
They're both awful.
Yeah.
My opinion.
Pick up the lid off of a toilet, smash it 9 times onto his shin, and finally just twist and break his foot loose.
You don't mean off,
okay.
Right?
I just listed the most graphic moments of Saw, and as Robert and I have both pointed out, as it worked out for the best for budgetary reasons, your brain is doing all of the work for you. All of it. Now, again, I said I was going to make a comparison, and I'm going to make a comparison. 7 is one of the most beloved thrillers of all time. Depending on who you ask and on what day, most people will tell you that either that or Fight Club is the definitive work of David Fincher. This movie, right here on screen, features and graphically depicts a man who has been chained to a bed and become riddled with disgusting pus-filled bed sores, a fat man who has been confined face down into a bowl of spaghetti and left to both die, rot, and, oh, yes, void his bowels.
Like you do.
Yeah, like you do. It's all happened to us at some point. Damn you, Olive Garden. But, oh, and we also have one of my personal favorites. We have man fucks woman with bladed penis. That was fun. We get the implication of a decapitation at the very end of the movie. And I know I'm forgetting several just because it's been years since I've seen Seven. I'm just rattling off the ones that I can think of off the top of my head. And if our good little junior woodchucks, Jason Teasley and Jesse Starcher, want to chime in at any second now with any that I've missed, by all means, guys, feel free. My feelings won't be hurt. That's all depicted right there on screen. Flat out, no punches pulled. It's just... boom, right there, fat shitty man choked on spaghetti. Boom, right there, woman gets razor fucked.
Also, yeah, I believe they actually walk in on that happening. If my memory of the film holds up.
You know what? I have never, in all the years I've been watching movies, heard as many people get as squeaky and uncomfortable about Seven as other people do when I mention that I'm a huge fan of the Saw franchise. In fact, I was talking to one of my closest friends today, and very, very early in the morning, my workday starts at about 5 a.m. Mountain Time usually, and she, of course, is on Central Time and was just starting her workday. And I was mentioning that my day was going to include copious amounts of writing and finishing up watching the first three Saw movies. And she tells me, ugh, I feel sorry for you. I said, any particular reason? I love the first three Saw movies. So you feel sorry for me because I get to watch three of the better horror movies anybody will ever see? Oh, I just personally don't like them. I don't like all the violence and torture. Head to desk.
This is a facepalm worthy of Patrick Stewart on the Starship Enterprise, folks.
Yes.
If not, the infamous double facepalm featuring both Picard and Riker.
Hang on. Sorry, I had to reset the warmer on my coffee pot. Here's the really important thing, though, that sets this apart from what everybody else refers to as torture porn. And yes, I admit, torture porn is a thing. It's a shitty thing. It really is exactly what the name implies. It is torture for the sake of torture. And at certain points, the Saw franchise does start to devolve toward that direction. However, for three movies, the ones that Juan and Juanel had a direct hand in, it wasn't torture porn yet. No, this is actually character-driven, and I'm going to use this as a segue, Robert, for you to introduce one of the very few characters that has managed in the past 15 years or so to become a legitimate, full-fledged, bona fide icon of horror movies.
All right. I believe he's referring to the Jigsaw character, and that's where I'm going because I love Tobin Bell.
No, Robert, God. I was referring to Zepp.
Well, I was referring to Zepp.
Well, of course, everything should be about Zepp.
It's Michael Emerson before he was in Lost, which actually made me want to strike him with the toilet lid. Different story, different topic. I'm getting off track. Okay, here's one of my favorite things about Jigsaw, and this is maybe just me, but I was attracted once I got into the story and the franchise because I very much enjoy logic puzzles, using my brain, paying attention. I'm not the best at it, but these are things that I tend to gravitate towards. Spy movies where you have to pay attention to what's going on. There's a reason for a long time the first of the Mission Impossible movies with Tom Cruise was my favorite. When you have to pay attention and focus and you're engaged, I like those things. And those are the scenarios that Jigsaw put you in. He would...
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
He puts you in a scenario. He very clearly explains the rules of said scenario, and it's up to you to figure out how to get out of there. And you have, and this is where you have, you pay attention to what he says, and this became kind of a theme for the second and third Saw movies, which we're going to get into. You pay attention, and you have to think about it in some cases laterally, not necessarily how it's presented to you, but you have to think about it. And all of the, and the flip side, all of his traps are escapable. Not all of the, you know, the odds may be small, don't get me wrong. I mean, hey, walk on broken glass, get a number that's located somewhere in thousands of numbers on this wall with a candle while covered in a flammable substance. I mean, don't get me wrong, odds small. But it is theoretically possible to get out of that.
May I politely disagree and be just a little bit pedantic?
By all means.
I want you to note, folks, at least when I say that, I'm not just trying to blatantly shout over Robert. I'm waiting for my moment and just politely interjecting something, even if it's a little bit of picking at nits. But, no, it's not so much even that the chances are small. If you really look at the traps, you can indeed get out. You will suffer grievous, oftentimes permanent bodily harm along the way. But it's all a part of Jigsaw's crusade. It's that you will come away damaged. You will come away scarred. You will come away forever changed inside and out. But you will be alive. You will see another sunrise. And as he tells Amanda, as that...
Billy tells Amanda.
As a creepy-ass, huggable little Billy doll tricycles his wooden ass into the room, so much... What is the exact line? That so many people don't know how lucky they are.
So many people are so ungrateful to be alive.
Yeah, there it is. Thank you. So many people are so ungrateful to be alive. Take a look at the people who survive. She survived, and she didn't come away necessarily physically scarred. She just came away with the unshakable memory that's going to haunt the back of her eyelids every night for the rest of her life.
Not very long, but...
Fair enough.
Well,
we didn't know that at this point.
No.
Nor, realistically, did she at the time. But that she plunged her hands into what she found out later was a living human being's intestines to pull out the key to unlock the device that was going to take her life. She was left with the fact that she had to kill another human being, a helpless human being, in an exceptionally gruesome way that he lived a good bit of the way through. But in the end, she was alive. She got at least one more day. And in the same vein, at the end of the movie, yes, Dr. Gordon has cut his foot off. On the other hand, he has a chance to live. He'll get out. He's shown how precious everything that he took for granted is. And keep in mind, at one point, his other option was basically, you have one of two ways you're getting out of here. Either you are lopping your foot off, or you're going to kill Adam. One or the other. Those are your choices. And actually, in a way, in a somewhat noble way, that was what he did. He didn't choose at that point to take a life or to aid in the taking of a life. He doesn't even necessarily go and just say, screw you, kid. You're partially responsible for me being here. I'm leaving you to rot. He actually goes over and tells him, and we're giving him the benefit of a doubt of sincerity here, tells him, I'm going to go get help. I'll be back. You know, actually somewhat tries to comfort him, even though he's doing it with what I'm sure he thinks are probably his last breaths. So,
yeah, and, well, kind of to your point, I was just going to say this. When I was watching this film and they talk about the guy who has a couple of hours to get through the, and this was a scene that for some reason unsettled, not for some reason, this was one of the scenes that unsettled people, was the guy trying to crawl through the razor wire. I looked at that basic setup and I thought, you know, that's going to suck, but it's more than doable. As long as you don't panic. Protect the major blood vessels, look at how you're going to get out of there, and just, don't get me wrong, it's going to hurt, and I don't wish to be put in that position to anyone out there listening, but I looked at that and objectively kind of went, you know, that's not the worst scenario you could be put in.
And you know, and think about the guy who has to walk on broken glass while carrying the candle around the room to read the combination that's written throughout the wall. I mean, it's right there on the wall pretty plainly. It's just repeated a bunch of times. Yes, you are going to have to proceed slowly, carefully, and methodically to keep from lighting yourself on fucking fire.
I always wondered why he didn't take a large piece of glass and scrape at least some of the substance off of him, but...
Yeah, that's another thing, but even that's going to cut you up. But
I'm just pointing things out, where my mind went.
Well, true, but however, that's not a death sentence. You can do it. It's going to hurt. You are going to be left with cuts and scars all over your feet. But I think the only way, arguably your biggest risk just from walking on the glass of dying would be maybe infection, and even then that would take hours. Unless it was one damn virulent, angry little bug. I mean something that would just make Gregory House pop a Vicodin and go, BAM! But it's a doable situation. You're going to incur pain. You're going to incur suffering. You're going to incur scars. You are going to be physically and emotionally damaged. But you will live. And even then, he's picking people that some of them, if you really think about it, kind of wouldn't, you could almost say, don't really deserve the chance.
In some instances, yes. That's...
Yeah, I mean, occasionally...
He chooses people who he feels need the lesson, and objectively you can kind of see, which is one of the fascinating things about the character, and one of my favorite things about the second Saw, which I want to segue into here, because Tobin Bell gets very little screen time, lines, anything in this film, and yet he's the one you kind of walk away with the memory of, and this is deliberate, of course. In the second film, you get to see him act. You get to see dialogue. You get to see him mess. You get to see him cornered by a SWAT team, smile politely, and ask for a glass of water. I mean, this is a man dying of brain cancer. Well, all kinds of cancer, but that's the kind of the imperative part there. And he just cares not at all for the position he's put in. And it's brilliant. And my favorite parts of 2 are when he's talking, and I don't care much for any of the Wahlbergs, but his interactions with Donnie Wahlberg, his dialogue, and the way they play off of each other in the second film are the highlights of that movie. Has nothing to do with the death traps or the violence or the other characters involved. Those two verbally and intellectually going at it is just brilliant. And if there's anything we've left off from the first film that you want to talk about, by all means, but we're halfway through our lifetime and we're just now getting into the second one. But that's also just how much I think we both love the first one.
Well, and this comes back to the second one too. And actually, things are really going to get dynamic when we talk about how the third movie diverts from this. And that is the fact, if you watch Teresa's Wolf Creek, practically anything Eli Roth has ever made, okay, that is torture for the sake of torture. That is people torturing others with the intent to eventually kill them. On the other hand, as Dr. fucking Gordon states himself right from the start in this movie, Jigsaw never actually kills anybody. It's the idea of you will suffer this symbolic torment in atonement for your sins, or your life will be forfeit. That's your choice. You either make the choice to atone now, or just you're done. Or you clearly don't appreciate your life enough to go on for me to allow you to go on living it. That's the whole point of this. So, in a sense, it's got an actual motivation. It's got an actual, a little bit of a moral tale that raises some questions of how sorry do I feel for these people whose deeds have really put them into this situation? What do they really deserve? Do they deserve to be put in a situation where one man says, okay, here's the deal. You either make up in one shot for everybody that you have ever hurt, or I'm never going to give you one more breath to hurt anybody again. And actually, as we move into this movie, it creates something about Jigsaw that's truly unique and unsettling. And that
you kind of agree with him.
Yeah, the fact that as we watch him, we are absolutely horrified and disgusted by the situation that he's put these other human beings into. But at the same time, you look at it and you think, I don't condone it, but I'm starting to question myself because I actually understand.
Which is one of the great... And I've mentioned this before, and I'll go ahead and do so now, because we're getting into the second one. When Jigsaw is talking about his backstory, what led him to how he kind of came to where he is, and he talks about, I got cancer, I tried to kill myself, and he goes through kind of, the cliff notes of his life to this point, and you understand, but you never sympathize. And this is something that I have complained about loudly and frequently with other horror villains, Jason, Michael Myers, Pinhead, Freddy Krueger at times, they turn them almost into anti-heroes because they're so popular. And nothing bugs me more than pointlessly trying to make you root for someone like Michael Myers. And you never get there with Jigsaw, and I just have to applaud everyone involved for not going over that line. And it's a tough line to toe sometimes, but when you do, everything is better off for it. So I absolutely have to commend everyone involved in that.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the first movie especially, you have a big, big difference between, say, Jigsaw, who always books himself either a front row seat for his games or a position as an active participant in them, versus, in particular, a scene that showcases not only just what an amazingly gripping performance Michael Emerson delivers, but also how incredibly convincing and real both Monica Potter and Mackenzie Vega respectively are as Dr. Gordon's wife and daughter. And that is the scene in which Monica, his wife, and Mackenzie, the daughter, are restrained in Dr. Gordon's bedroom. Zepp has got them tied up, gagged. They're pleading through their gags, and not in an overly hammed up fashion, in about the way you expect a hostage really would. Not that hopefully anybody out there would really know what that's like, but in a way that you just viscerally sense, yeah, this isn't being overdone. This is not comical. This is.
But if
this
you
is
want
to,
if you want something comparable, loosely comparable, mind you, but something loosely comparable. I can never remember the actress, but the senator's daughter from the Silence of the Lambs movie.
I don't remember either. Yeah, that's another good one. That's comparable. But anyway, the difference is in this scene, you have Zepp just, who keep in mind also is a participant in his own game in this movie. Because what we've got is we've got a series of fractured stories that we get to watch coalesce into this intriguing, multifaceted whole right before our eyes. Zepp, in the course of his own game, is deciding that because reasons, he just wants to fuck with them. We see him take Dr. Gordon's stethoscope and use it to listen to Mackenzie Vega's heart and hears it obviously pounding furiously. Then he pulls a gun and starts aiming it on and about her head and her mother's, and then puts the stethoscope up to her heart again just so that he can hear its beat double. Okay. That's somebody who is actually beginning to take some glee in the torment he's inflicting on people versus Jigsaw not so much perhaps enjoying his work, but feeling some satisfaction in what he feels he has the chance to accomplish on a grand scale in other individuals' lives by perhaps going to drastic measures, but ultimately leaving them with an appreciation for everything that's around them. That is the difference between Saw and torture porn.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And, okay, moving on to the second one, because, again, we're short out of live time, and we have two more movies to discuss. Brief synopsis for the second one, again. Jigsaw is found in an industrial building. He's cornered by a SWAT team, a detective who briefly appears in the first one, I can never remember her name, and Donnie Wahlberg's character.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Now, it is very briefly set up that Donnie Wahlberg, Detective Eric Matthews, has a tumultuous relationship with his son. He's in the process of being divorced. His life's kind of falling apart. They corner Jigsaw. Jigsaw then directs them to a bank of monitors, which reveal Detective Matthews' son and an assortment of other motley individuals who are engaged in one of Jigsaw's games. He then proceeds to, he tells Detective Matthews, if you want to get your son back alive and safe, all you have to do is sit here and talk to me. If you do that for long enough, everything's going to be okay. No.
Hang on. The exact words were, you'll find your son in a safe and secure place. Oh, Tobin, don't tickle my funny bone that way. Jesus can see you.
But yeah, that's what. And it turns out, it gets revealed that now, while people are dying off, the guys in the house have a game wherein they're all slowly being poisoned with a variation of sarin nerve gas, which for anyone who's seen the movie The Rock knows how nasty that stuff is, from a cinematic standpoint.
Did they ever play with sarin?
He references the Chinese subway attacks, which were a derivation of sarin gas.
Okay, yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I guess he did. Okay.
So, nasty stuff, and I don't feel compelled to go into it. They'll die, is kind of the sum total here. There are antidotes hidden around this house full of traps that they're all stuck in, and they all begin dying off one by one, as you do in a Saw movie. Your life expectancy is not great, generally speaking. They start killing each other, dying off. There are traps. Shawnee Smith returns as Amanda. We're led to believe because she attempted to commit suicide, and Jigsaw found this distasteful, as he would, logically speaking. She gets thrown into a pit full of syringes in a sequence that, to this day, makes me just go, ugh! I watched that movie in theaters, and I just about came out of my seat. It just, more so than anything else in this movie or any others, that just kind of sets my skin to crawling.
And yes, if you can endure it, it is legit. And don't get me wrong, Shawnee Smith is absolutely brilliant in all three of these movies. But it is her expression, her mannerisms, everything from the time that Frankie G pitches her into that pit. It's absolutely striking. It absolutely makes the entire scene. Because keep in mind, we're talking about a former drug addict here who has just been pitching the game.
And these are not clean needles.
Just to add a
little bit of skin crawliness.
That's the other important thing to note. In fact, the whole thing about the cast is really, this movie was not directed by James Wan. James and Lee Whannell did some cleanup on a script that somebody else had completely written, that Darren Lynn Bousman, I believe, had written completely independent of the Saw franchise, but that Lionsgate wanted to mold and
If memory serves, the screenplay he wrote was called The Desperate, something to that effect.
He
tried to shop it around, but the problem was he wrote this independent of the franchise, but a lot of it lined up, and a lot of studio executives' response was, well, it's too much like Saw, we don't really want to get into that. So eventually it got to Lionsgate. Lionsgate approached him and said, you know, we'll buy it, we'll work with it, we want to turn it into an installment in the franchise. James Wan, Lee Whannell came in, and they, what was their line? they kept like all of the kills and traps the same, but they injected everything about the Saw universe that makes it great into that movie.
I think
James Wan said you could read the script while watching the second, while watching the movie, and you wouldn't necessarily draw a correlation.
Yeah, it's really funny because everybody else was going, that's too much like Saw. We don't want to make that. Lionsgate was like, hey, that's just like Saw. Let's make that. But the thing is, the big difference maker, I think, between the two was the fact that Darren Lynn Bousman himself came on to direct it. And for the record, I won't go so far as to say that he did a bad job. And in fact, I'll even posit that I think this movie gets a lot harsher criticism than it deserves.
I maintain that there are areas in which the second film is superior to the first.
And I could see how some would feel that way. However, the biggest area where it differs is the fact that Bousman doesn't have the sort of methodical, slow-boiling patience that James Wan has. He does everything from the way he edits to the way he develops characters at a very breathless pace. Everything is quick cuts, quick action. There are none of the excellent lingering shots that really built up the unease of the first one and then effectively delivered with perfect timing and then moved on just as immaculately. That's not the case here. In this case, everything is rapid fire. It's not nearly as intricate. Maybe it is in story structure, but in terms of the relationships between the characters, nothing is really built up quite so effectively, or quite so gradually. It just casts you headlong right into anything, right down to the fact that the movie starts you off with a trap.
Which became a hallmark of further instances of this franchise.
Well, right, and for better or worse, you got to give Lionsgate this. Lionsgate listens to the fans. Coming into this one, they asked them, okay, what did you like about the first one? Did you like the characters? Did you like the story? Or were you far more entranced by the traps that we hinted at? And then asked, what would you like to see more of in the second movie? And lo and behold, everybody said, the traps. And as a result, you get everything happening on a much larger, more needlessly complex scale, especially in terms of the fact that you have characters here that you really don't need, that you could proceed without, and you wouldn't feel a sense that anything was lost, especially, in particular, Beverly Mitchell, who played one of the middle children on Seventh Heaven.
I maintain she's completely superfluous in everything.
Yeah, but in this she's particularly useless. She's there pretty much as an external bracing stud for the walls around the house they're all locked in. She spends the entire thing either sobbing or leaned against a wall, or sobbing while leaned against a wall with her boobs half falling out. That's about it.
Yep.
That's about all there is to it. Really, the only ones who get any seriously engaging traps throughout the entire thing. Obi, who is played by an actor whose name I don't recall, but who turns in a creepy, frankly mesmerizing performance for the limited time he's there, is an arsonist who's helped to kidnap everybody and who, as a reward, pretty much gets cooked alive down in the basement.
The actor's name is Timothy Bird.
Timothy Bird, thank you. Frankie G plays a pretty damn ruthless drug dealer. he's the one for whom the needle pit was designed, but he opportunistically chooses to chuck Amanda in there. There was a Latina woman who was a repeated thief whose trap to get the antidote was she had to stick her hands in a razor-equipped cage and pretty much slit her own wrist to get it. Those are the only real themed traps for the people who are in the house. And if I missed anybody, I apologize, but I really don't think I did.
As far as traps go, no. Apart from the death mask in the opening sequence.
So in one of the classic instances of 50 pounds of shit in a 5-pound bag, Bowsman has to try to introduce these 8 people and somehow make us care about all of them. And quite frankly, he fails because it's an impossible task, because he's got to do this while he's also constantly going back and forth between that and the ongoing tied-in game between Jigsaw and Detective Matthews back at the warehouse. And you don't even really develop any serious investment in Detective Matthews' son, except for he's a bratty-ass delinquent teenager, and quite frankly, we're kind of expected to care for no other reason except that's Donnie Wahlberg's boy. Okay.
That's
not going to work, because I don't even care what happens to Donnie Wahlberg.
Yeah, he's a dirty cop. Why should we care about him? This franchise, that's one of the other things that kind of starts to bug me as it goes on, is we go from characters that we are invested in to one degree or another that we care about to a bunch of people just being on screen for the sake of being in traps. This is the more dinosaurs syndrome, people. And what I mean by that, and Mark Radulich has schooled me several times on the phrase and what it means, instead of looking at a film and looking at, hey, what made it work? What were the story elements? What were the acting, the characters? You know, instead of dissecting the film itself and figuring out what made it work, why it worked, and how to successfully replicate, build upon, etc., you get more dinosaurs. And that's what you get with Saw as you go on and on and on. Well, that first one was good. Let's make more of it. Well, okay. We need decent names. We need actors with some capabilities. We need this kind of a setup. Nah, screw that. More traps. And that's kind of where we go. But, just to kind of close out the storyline here, eventually Donnie Wahlberg loses patience with Jigsaw's games. He begins to beat him in an attempt to get the information about where his son's being held. This being kind of the end game Jigsaw wanted, turns out he goes, fine, you win, game over, I'll take you to the house. They leave without any other police presence because Jigsaw demands it. He takes them to the house. At the same time, the technical unit for the local police department, who are so... I don't even want to go into that. That's a different discussion. But at the same time, they figure out where the broadcast is coming from. So the SWAT team mounts up and heads over to that location. And what follows is basically a spiritual retread or homage to a very famous sequence from Silence of the Lambs. And if you've seen that movie, wherein James Gum is going about his house, the FBI is setting up outside of his house, and just they very slowly show you sequences of him doing stuff, the FBI setting up, the doorbell rings, he goes to answer it, as at the same time the SWAT team breaks into the house. And it turns out that, well, that was Clarice in wherever, West Virginia, I think, or no, I forget where it was. But that was actually Clarice doing follow-up on her bit of the investigation, and she's found Ted Levine as the real serial killer, while the FBI's tactical assault unit, including Scott Glenn as Jack Crawford, has broken into an empty house. And it's a brilliant bit of cinema. It absolutely is a brilliant bit of editing. And Mr. Winfrey, how does that compare to this? Well, it turns out that this... the monitors that we were watching the whole time with Donnie Wahlberg and Jigsaw were actually pre-recorded. Everything had already happened. The FBI or the SWAT team breaks into the building that is broadcasting what's already happened, and Donnie Wahlberg actually winds up at the real location. Amanda drugs him in the basement because she's turned out to be Jigsaw's apprentice, and leaves him to die in the same industrial basement, in the same industrial toilet where that the first movie took place in. And we close the film with a great bit of a beaten and bloody Jigsaw leaning over in a van, and he just kind of starts to smile as he hears Matthew start screaming for help.
Folks, just like after a night of dinner and dancing at Taco Bell, you are never escaping that bathroom.
No, you are not. But okay, so that's... Again, for those of you keeping track, that's kind of the storyline as far as that goes. Now, I think we've touched on everything that I really wanted to touch on, apart from further singing the praises of Tobin Bell, who just... And, oh, I did forget to mention, Jigsaw's little jibe about if you just sit here and talk to me long enough, you'll find your son in a safe and secure location. Well, there's a timer that was in the room with them. It reaches zero. The safe that was about 3 feet away from Jigsaw in a corner of his room opens on a timer, and there's little Danny Wahlberg. I don't know. Danny Matthews, I believe, is the character's name. Yeah, it is. It's Danny Matthews. Eric Knudsen is the actor. And he was in that safe with an oxygen mask the whole time. And all he had to do was sit there and talk with Jigsaw until the timer hit zero, and all would have been well with the world.
It's worth noting that little Mr. Hudson survived Jigsaw, but he eventually got knifed by Ghostface.
And not just Ghostface, but wasn't that the... Yeah, but yeah, he couldn't... Ghostface killed him.
Yes. Long story short, he's the only one who has been in sequels for both Saw and Scream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, in addition to... me again praising Tobin Bell, who sits there cancer-ridden, well, you know, get character speaking, surrounded by burly SWAT officers and angry policemen, and is just absolutely giving zero grams of fuck about what's going on around him. It's one of the most surreal things in the world, and you look at Tobin Bell, and as an actor, he is still able to make you believe, no, you're in my house. This is my game. You're just pawns.
You know, really, all things considered, you have to look at Tobin Bell, and you have to consider him the one and only undefeated horror villain.
That's true.
He is, seriously, the man is the Rocky Marciano of horror. Because as we're going to see by the time we're done with this entire franchise, in the end, he wins.
Well, let me say he has never had to deal with the incomparable might of one Ashley J. Williams, sir.
No, he hasn't, but I mean... Here's the thing, and here's where I've got to refer back to my notes a little bit. Tobin Bell, this guy could kind of make the Joker quake in fear. Because, for one thing, allow me to run down for you the short list of his apparent applicable skills. Electrician, makeup artist, engineer, chemist, mask, toy, and model maker, maker of booby traps. He's a student of history. He is an incomparable strategist. The man built a fog machine. And that's just really scratching the surface. That's without getting into to everything else that he's good at, like the fact that he apparently makes a lot of his own clothes. He's got more than a little acumen for makeup artistry. Apparently has a gift for quiet under-the-table investment in property for all the buildings he's apparently able to own and maintain.
Or they're just abandoned and he knows where they are, but still, that's no mean feat of as far as scouting locations.
That too. The man is incredibly phenomenally talented. I mean, just in every possible way that he really could be. There have been few villains, few killers quite like him. And he planned, and by the end of the entire series, we see just how far out he extrapolated every possible outcome and just covered every single last angle. I mean,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, the depth of thought.
He even kind of put a lot of thought into how to carry things forward, as we see in the next movie, as the man was laying there virtually incapacitated by an inoperable frontal lobe tumor that was increasingly pressing against his brain.
Yeah, and even there, you know, even after he's had the amateur brain surgery, he's still the one in charge, and you still kind of know he's thought about this. He knew he was going to die, so he clearly planned for this contingency.
Not only that, he not only knew he was going to die, but he could obviously tell that for as much as he very obviously cared about and loved Amanda, that she had really lost the plot when it came to his work. Jigsaw is a teacher. Jigsaw aims to teach. He aims to force people onto a path to either redemption or destruction and then let them choose. He's somewhat of a student of human behavior. Amanda, on the other hand, Amanda is just a punisher. That's it. As we learn throughout the next movie, and it's where things really start falling apart, Amanda doesn't seek to teach. She doesn't seek to give people another chance because she doesn't see the subjects of these traps as being worthy of second chances. She's just there to make sure that in their last moments before their lives are suddenly and painfully and gruesomely ended, that every single person who's subjected to them is thinking long and hard about all the decisions that got them to that point. And that's where things start becoming a whole lot less intriguing, Robert.
Oh, yeah. All right. We're moving into the third one now, and just as a bit of a disclaimer, we've got 25 minutes of live time left, and there will be, given how we've been going, there will be an overrun. It's up to an hour. I will post the link after this is all archived and everything, so when we cut off, if we're still talking, if we haven't wrapped up in the next 15 minutes, the third Saw movie, I'll get a link out to the full archived version, and once again, thank you all for listening, if you're listening live or later, and this is just superfluous gum flapping, so to speak. All right, moving into the third film, we find Jigsaw about to die. His time's about up. His cancer has progressed to the point where we're talking, you know, days, maybe a week if he's lucky. And he decides that he is now going to enact his final bit of the final bit that he's going to do for his legacy. And let me say this. Let me get this disclaimer out there before I get into my issues with this film, and I'll talk about the good things as well. But before I get into my issues, I want to say this. The overarching emotional narrative that they try to tell with the third Saw movie actually is interesting to me personally.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's got this character played by Angus McFadden, actor I'm a fan of. The poor guy just has not quite caught the necessary breaks. But I like the guy, and his life has basically ground to a halt following the tragic death of his 8-year-old son. A car accident, his son was on his bike, he got hit by a car, Terrible tragedy. But his life has now ground to a halt. He's neglecting his wife, he's neglecting his daughter, he's constantly fantasizing about revenge or suicide. I mean, just he never grieved and moved on, and his life is consumed with vengeance. And Jigsaw's goal with this game, as far as Angus McFadden's character is concerned, is going to teach him that you have to forgive, to let go, to move on with your life, and make it continue to be worth living. I like that as an emotional narrative. It's something that Jigsaw would try to do, logically. It might even be, since this is the last appearance of John Kramer, as he's alive, we get more of John Kramer in the next ones, but they're all flashbacks. But it's something that he would probably be reflecting on as he's on his literal deathbed, and wanting to impart to everyone around you that, you know, it's a message that he would want to send people. And so I like it. I like the theme that he's trying to get to. It's more the choices that the director and the writers have kind of made along the way that gum up the works. But I like the overarching narrative. I really do. And I want to kind of applaud James Wan and Lee Whannell, who came back for this one. They weren't necessarily sold on the idea of a third movie after the second. They kind of came to the conclusion that, well, they'll make a third one with or without us. So we may as well be involved, and we'll try to come up with something.
Well, there was a little bit more to it than that.
Good.
What really motivated them to come back, because really initially they did have no intentions whatsoever of coming back. But then what happened was, I believe it was, I'm probably going to get the timing wrong on this. I believe right around, either right before or right immediately after Saw 2 premiered, Greg Hoffman, the producer who was largely responsible for helping to develop Saw into a full-fledged feature film, tragically died of natural causes. And
after.
Yes,
it was
after.
As a brief note, it was right. After.
Right. Despite the fact that creatively this was obviously James Wan and Lee Whannell's baby, Greg was the one who really made it possible on the scale on which it actually really happened. So what they decided to do was they really got the band back together one more time. It would be the last movie that would collectively entirely involve James, Lee, Bousman, and, of course, as always, composer Charlie Clouser, all of them on the same project.
Oh, brief note, because I hadn't touched on it yet, and I really am sorry to cut you off, but I cannot say enough good things about Charlie Clouser and the soundtrack that he crafted, especially for the first film. I, for some reason, did only this last... The last time I watched it, I was able, you know, I actually was aware of the soundtrack and processed it on kind of on a more intellectual level, probably because I was looking for things like that. And Benjamin J. Cologne, our great title card artist, who incidentally knocked it out of the park by putting me in the reverse bear trap and Sean taking off the Billy mask this time around. Great job. Seriously, hats off to the guy. He does great work. But he mentioned to me that he puts the soundtrack for the first Saw movie up there with the great horror soundtracks of all time. And, I mean, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, Hellraiser, you know, all the classics. And I thought about it because I wasn't sure if I agreed or not. And I looked up the full track listing. I listened to some of them independently. And I can't disagree. It is one of the best horror soundtracks ever, and I really have to, because I haven't given him enough praise for that, and I deliberately wanted to, especially before we go off live, live air. But Charlie Clouser just absolutely rocked the soundtracks for especially the first one, but the succeeding two are not a substantial drop off in quality. So okay, my gushing's over.
Well, I mean, it's justifiably so, because it's an absolute masterclass in-house, something that so often goes so tragically overlooked, is an essential part to developing a mood that these movies really don't succeed without. But kind of getting back to things, though, the whole idea was the fact that those three wanted to, in honor of Greg, and since they really believed that this would indeed be the swan song for their baby, wanted to make something that was personal in that it brought the focus back to relationships between characters. Of course, obviously the very father-daughter dynamic between Jigsaw and Amanda, but also taking a close look at how this trap's particular victim was being punished, because in the wake of his child's death, he had started to take everything that was still alive and well around him for granted and really didn't appreciate it. And I'm not going to comment too much on that, because that's a very sensitive subject, and considering that I'm not a father and I really have no plans to be, I have no right even speculating on what a parent having to bury a child has got to be like. But it does set up one of the more gripping lessons, and actually, I would go so far as to say an absolutely fascinating performance by Angus McFadden throughout it, as we watch him develop as he's forced down the path of grieving that he's been so hesitant up to this point to even take a first step down. But last but not least, we also get a look at the deteriorating marriage of, Lynn Denlin. Can't read my own handwriting. Lynn Denlin, as she just becomes increasingly numb to the world, just doesn't really feel anything within herself. The woman is a trauma surgeon, and at one point during the movie, we get to watch her just bodily go through the motions of saving a child's life. Robert, probably about the way you and I go about, you know, paying our bills every month.
Yeah, that's just about right.
It's just something we do, get it done, go somewhere and have a snack, and go take a nap. That's about it. There's not even a sense of urgency, and she does it successfully. But she's so robotic in how she goes about everything that now all of a sudden, apparently, Jigsaw believes that she too has to be jolted into that sense of having some importance to the world around her.
Yeah, it's and it's interesting watching the performance that she gives, because she starts off, even when she's now, you know, being held with a collar with, what was it, 5 or 6, I assume 12-gauge shotgun shells pointed at her head, in her little bit of, in her little trap. And when she goes into, you know, you can see when she goes into doctor and hospital mode, because everything kind of shuts down and she's giving textbook answers, literal textbook answers, mind you, nothing figurative there by and large. And just, you can see the character kind of shut down emotionally at little intervals and very slowly, and in some cases, suddenly, she is brought back around to kind of being alive again while trying to help Jigsaw and avoid her own untimely demise. and dealing with Amanda, who is slowly losing her grip on reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really, you know, there were so many about all three of these first three movies have such really great, you know, maybe kind of understated at times performances by all of the cast, and it's something that really needs mentioning frequently as far as these movies go. Nobody turns in a really bad performance in the traditional sense of the word.
No, not at all. So, actually, believe it or not, even the child actors are outstanding.
You know, if we could get child actors half that good on a regular basis, I wouldn't rail against them so frequently.
Right.
And we all know I hate child actors. I mean, they're one of the banes of my existence. Right up there with the Smurfs. And Michael Bay.
Damn little blue fucks.
All right, so kind of, again, we'll do a brief plot synopsis here for the third one. Jigsaw's dying. He has Amanda kidnap Dr. Lin. And his goal with her is very specifically, you're going to keep me alive until this trap is done. Then you're free to go. I just can't die until this is over. And she's put in a position, again, the collar with a bunch of live shotgun rounds pointed at her head. It's mounted, and it's connected to his heart rate monitor, so if he flatlines, it goes off, she dies, head goes boom. His game, ostensibly, and I say that because things are never exactly what they seem as far as these goes, involves, as we mentioned, Angus McFadden, and being put in a position to decide the fates of people who were involved with the death of his son and him trying to emotionally move on. There's a woman who saw what happened but didn't come forward and testify, the judge who gave the motorist a light sentence, and finally the driver himself. He has to decide if he's going to forgive these people and save them or watch them die in horrible ways. And all this leads to him confronting Jigsaw, at which point Amanda has now lost her grip on reality. Jigsaw's been alive long enough to see the conclusion of this. He tells her to let Dr. Lin go. Amanda doesn't. Amanda shoots her. Turns out that Lin is actually Angus McFadden's wife. He then shoots Amanda in the neck. Jigsaw reveals this was actually all your game because I knew you were screwing with my legacy and you were crafting traps that people couldn't possibly escape from even if they followed the rules. And a couple of them were pretty gnarly, which we'll get to the individual traps, I assume, at some point in the near future. And she bleeds out on the floor. He looks at Angus McFadden, who has stabilized his wife, more or less. He says, I can have an ambulance here in 4 minutes. I'm actually the one responsible for the loss of your child. Here's your final choice. You can either forgive me, and everyone can kind of move on from this, or you've got all these fun little instruments to exact your painful revenge, and you can see where that road takes you. He proceeds to slash his throat with a circular saw. Cool visual, incidentally enough, of the first time Angus picks up that circular saw and it's going and his eyes are just wide enough to be crazy. It's unsettling in the best way possible. Slashes his throat. His heart, Jigsaw triggers a last tape recording that says, congratulations, you've killed your wife, because his heart rate, he dies, heart rate goes flat, thing goes boom, wife's head goes bye-bye. I wasn't lying when I said I was responsible for taking your child. Your daughter is locked in a room, and she only has a limited supply of air left, and if you want her back, you'll have to play a game. Fade out. Credits roll. That's where that kind of comes to its close. And that's...
Yeah, you know what? I'm sorry. A big part... Don't get me wrong. I like Saw 3. I really do. I enjoy it a lot more than most people do. The part that bothers me, and I realize that, yes, plays into the fact that Amanda is put in charge a lot of this and not Jigsaw, and that's the reason for this, is the fact that the previous traps didn't involve Jigsaw necessarily passing judgment on more than one... Well, how do I explain this? No, that's because I'm going to be wrong if I say it that way.
Well, you say it, and I might be able to offer a different perspective might be more accurate.
Let's just break this down here. Jigsaw has kidnapped the people that he has seen as being involved in this child's death. The various people, either because they didn't give a statement to police about who was responsible, you know, driver got away with it.
I'm sorry, just as a brief aside, this is unrelated, but Tobias Beecher gets 8 years in Oz, where he is summarily raped by Schillinger for years on end. This guy gets 6 months.
Yeah.
Unrelated, but same crime, essentially.
Right. You know, got off life, the judge didn't deliver a harsh enough sentence. These aren't the reasons why Jigsaw punishes people. He punishes people who don't appreciate their lives. This is just Jigsaw just straight up passing judgment. This is no longer Jigsaw the teacher. This is Jigsaw the judge. This is This is the point where it starts really getting past the whole center of what Saw has been up to that point. You took your life for granted. You led a bad life. In the case of Saw 2, as we'll find out later in the franchise, he actually had a direct connection over the course of his genesis from John into Jigsaw with the people that he trapped in the house. That all ties together. In this case, and you know what? I also want to throw in there the death of Dina Meyer's character, too, because that one really bothered me.
It did.
Because
it bugged me.
Not because of the nature of the trap, but because, again, it's another thing that Jigsaw just doesn't do. In this case, when he kills, he's going on the offensive. He is actually going out there and now actually going and actively killing somebody who's trying to bring him to justice. The previous traps that he set up, yes, indeed, they were there to do away with anybody who would do harm to him or try to interrupt his work. However, they were set up for the people when they came to him, when they took a step over the line and wouldn't keep themselves out of it. You had to actually enter his inner sanctum. In this case, it's not even a case, I mean, at least even with Eric Matthews, he was kind of trying to make the case to him, you wrongly accused, you have planted evidence on people just to bring them to justice, and what's more, you're so wrapped up in being a cop that you've forgotten you have a son. He's trying to teach Eric a lesson. With Dina Meyer's character, that's not the case. There is no lesson to be learned here. It's just simply, you're in a trap, and, oh, by the way, this is all an illusion. You actually have no chance of getting out of here alive. None whatsoever. You're boned. I just want to watch you try to suffer through this before you go.
Yeah. Which was Amanda's contribution to Jigsaw's life. I mean, that's one of the things that bugs Jigsaw about it. He doesn't, and he brings this up later. Yeah, Amanda's not testing people, and Jigsaw continually refers to his victims, and I'll say victims, he refers to them as test subjects. He's testing their will to live, and, you know, as a test subject, it's kind of on you. He refers to, and then he tells Amanda at the end, your test subjects were just victims, because there was no way out for them. And it, you know, it's an important distinction as far as Jigsaw goes. I mean, because it's the core of his work. He's testing your will to live and what's going on with you, and if there's no point to that, then you're just killing people in creative ways. And there's no point to it.
Well, and also at this point, yeah, and it's also getting away from the whole fact that up to this point, Jigsaw can honestly say he never actually killed anybody. He didn't even ultimately end up killing Taft. Sliced his throat.
For those of you who don't know, Tap survived the throat slicing incident. He got the cane voice modulator
for a couple of weeks,
I assume. He wound up dying in a fight with Michael Emerson back in the first film. So even the guy he assaulted, he didn't kill.
No. To be honest, I'm sure he probably didn't care if he had killed Tap or not. But in that case, in Jigsaw's mind anyway, it was a matter of self-defense. He did what he did so that he wouldn't be brought to justice. It wasn't the case of him just kind of killing for the sake of killing, or actually going out with an intent to necessarily kill. The killing part just kind of happened. When Singh got his head blown off by a chorus line of shotguns that were connected to a tripwire and tied above a doorway, in Jigsaw's mind anyway, that was because, well, Singh was actively giving chase.
Well, and he could have stepped over the tripwire.
Yeah, so in Jigsaw's mind, your fault. You tripped it. You weren't being cautious. You were just sprinting after me. Now, obviously, that's not entirely correct, but it still wasn't a case where he set something up explicitly with the idea in mind, I am going to specifically kill this person. In her case, again, it was a matter of the tape didn't detail any particular lesson. There was nothing she was meant to learn from this.
I believe the rather shallow justification given, and I assume that at this point Amanda had the voice modulator that Jigsaw had been using, because the only justification he gave was, and I'm going to try and remember this, you're more comfortable amongst the dead than the living, you're not living your life, you're obsessed with your work, something. I mean, it's shallow and it's not necessarily accurate, and it was all just kind of pretense to kill her.
It is a big, big damn reach. So.
But yeah, I agree. And, okay, here's the other thing I wanted to say, since we're kind of getting towards the things I don't like about this movie. We talked a lot about this, and I feel compelled to kind of bring this up. In the second one, yes, there's more on-screen violence than in the first, which kind of goes along with that. I mean, I mentioned this before, that the second one is, by and large, it's a logical continuation and escalation of what took place in the first.
Yeah.
And we get to three, and it's similar. You can kind of say the same thing, except in this case, we need more traps, we need more violence, seems to be the, you know, mandate from those who hold the almighty checkbook.
Yeah.
And it bugs me to death, because I'm okay. Brief anecdote that I promise is relevant to this. And anyone listening live, this is 30-second. Your 30-second warning. Full show will be posted, and you can hear my anecdote then. I had an English teacher in high school who gave what I thought was a wonderful lecture on the nature of things that are gratuitous. For those of you who may not necessarily know what that means off the top of your head, gratuitous is things that are excessive, that serve no point. And the examples that she provided were that, first of all, the nudity in the film Titanic was not gratuitous. It served a narrative purpose. In addition to being a plot purpose, it served its beauty and art, and et cetera, et cetera. She found the levels of profanity in the film a lot more offensive because they served no purpose. They were just there to kind of be there. And I thought about that, and it resonated. You know, it made sense. I mean, if you want another example, the violence in the film Gladiator is not gratuitous because it fits with the narrative. It serves a purpose. It's not there just to be there. A lot of the violence that you get in the first and the second Saw films follows that vein. It's there to serve the narrative purpose. I mean, it's a bit more graphic. I mean, one guy gets his head smacked with a baseball bat that has nails sticking out of it, and it's, you know, kind of gnarly. But again, it's within the narrative. And then we get to 3, and we start. For me, the sequence with the driver who killed his son, and the way he's killed, and the way it's depicted, to me was just, it was excessive. It was not necessary to do that as they did it. And then we naturally have the somewhat lingering shot on the remains of the doctor's head after the shotgun shells have gone off. There was just a lot of what was depicted in this film that I looked at and went, you know, you're pushing it. And they would then leap over whatever cliff they were pushing towards in further sequels, but we'll get to that later. That's just what kind of bugged me about this one, was we got away from what was happening serving the narrative purpose and more trying to craft a weak narrative to show, to display disturbing imagery. And there's a substantial difference between the two, and it's one of those things that bugs me personally. And that's just me, and you guys out there may feel differently.
No, I mean, you are right. And to a certain point, the traps kind of even stop being symbolic. In a way, I mean, some of them previously at least had a little bit of a sense of symbolism, especially in the first movie. Especially I'm thinking about, again, the guy who had the flammable substance slathered all over his skin and then was poisoned. The whole idea in the tape was, you've spent so much time burning people with your lies. You know, now if you don't want to burn yourself, you're going to have to suffer. Or the one before that, the infamous razor wire maze. That was a punishment designed for somebody who had tried to slide a straight razor over his wrists. And he even tells him, to survive this time, you're going to have to cut yourself repeatedly.
Yeah, I'd say even the death mask, the trap that starts off the second film, kind of falls into that same vein of, this is a snitch, and actually masks of that nature kind of went on people like that. Informants, snitches, traitors, things of that nature. And the fact that the key was hidden behind his eye, I mean, there was some symbolism there. I get what you're saying. And in this one,
right.
We get, that's a
and you
cool
know what?
Idea.
I'll even extrapolate that and even say that's at least something positive that I can say about the traps in the 7th movie. They made perfect sense. They made sense in the context of the crimes for which the victim was being punished. And you know, I'll even say that about 6, even though 6 is by far my least favorite of all of the Saw movies. And God knows in 2 weeks we're going to get into why. But in this one, just not always much.
It just seemed like, okay, what's a fun way to kill someone? Well, if we put them in a meat locker that's freezing and sprayed them with water, they'd eventually freeze, and we could have that, and that's kind of a cool visual. Or
guy
chained to the bottom of a, whatever that is. It's a container that they wound up dropping liquefied rancid pig meat into, and we'll drown him that way because he's stuck to the bottom of it. Or the last sequence with his version of the rack that isolates both hands, both your feet and your neck, and then slowly twists them beyond the point of where they're supposed to twist.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to make it symbolic, you know what? Make it obviously symbolic. It's horror. you don't need to necessarily make it complicated. In fact,
it's better when it's simple.
Exactly. Because if you try to make a horror movie that complex, well, then you're just going to get called out for being just a little bit on the pretentious side. You know, less is sometimes more.
If you want an example of horror movies that went too far trying to explain things, that's a long list, and they tend to be bad movies.
Right. I mean, God knows I hate the Nightmare on Elm Street sequels with a deep-seated passion, but for as much as so many of Freddy's gimmicky little kills are kind of, at least they kind of make sense. At least the symbolism is, pardon the pun, painfully obvious. In Saw 3 especially, if you were trying to kind of make a statement about each party involved in that crash's guilt or level thereof, you kind of failed. You kind of failed pretty miserably, actually. So,
yeah,
I don't know. Is there anything really left to say about 3 except for the fact that this would have been the best possible place to leave off?
If you were going to make 3 movies, yes, it would be the best possible place to leave off.
I take corrected. I do have one more thing that I just have to add. A little bit of trivia about Shawnee Smith's involvement in the first 3 movies. Keep something in mind. When she filmed that brief little scene in the first movie, that was a half day of work that she had to be talked into by her agent, that she filmed throughout the day with a fever. And it is arguably one of the very most memorable parts of the movie and sets up the entire arc for a pivotal character in the next 2. That's not bad for a half day of work that she probably had to dope herself up to do effectively.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that is I feel somewhat comparable was Tobin Bell, who got paid to, by and large, if you watch what he does in the first movie, there's a lot of lying around. He's laying down in a bed, being talked about because of his cancer. He's laying on the tile floor. He's laying on the tile floor a little bit more. We get a flashback to him lying in the bed, and then he stands up. And don't get me wrong, I love that sequence. It's awesome. But I got to imagine that was a pretty decent payday for a guy to just do nothing but lay around all the time.
You know what? Not only that, but not only pretty decent payday, but
Turning it into the most iconic horror character of the last decade?
Yes, it made him the horror icon of the 2000s.
Hands down. I mean, there's nobody close. I'd go so far as there's not even a character that's close. And that includes Ghostface and all of his iterations.
And that's mostly because you can't really... That's in part because you can't really credit just one actor to that, though. Because when Ghostface is actually on screen, especially during the chase scenes, he ultimately ends up being kind of clumsily waylaid at some point or another.
The guy takes more bumps than Shawn Michaels.
Oh, God, that just makes me think of just Shawn's SummerSlam match against Hogan alone.
That was deliberate. That's the mental image I want you all to have of Ghostface making his chase. He trips over the sofa and performs at least 2 full rotations before landing on his head.
Oh, God. I know which part of the match you're calling back to. You're calling back to the part where Shawn takes Hogan's big boot and proceeds to pay homage to Monty Python's Colin Bomber Harris wrestling himself for 2 out of 3 falls. Just throws himself just around, for almost just one full tour all the way around the ring. Before he finally...
I seem to recall him taking that boot, falling down, standing up, wobbling around drunkenly, then falling back down just as Hogan is taking the final step to deliver the big leg drop.
More or less, but the silver medal bump to that, and because it's the one where you actually get to, during the match, see, I don't think Hulk Hogan so much as Terry fucking Bollea just get utterly pissed off. And
that
actually
slams his
yep.
head into the turnbuckle, and Shawn then proceeds to do a front flip and land on the outside of the ring.
Oh, no, that one's glorious, too. But the one I'm thinking of was the one when, oh, God, I don't know. I don't remember if Hogan actually threw him out or if Hogan just punched him and Shawn threw himself over the top rope.
Oh, God, yes.
And then about a third of the way up the entrance ramp. And you actually, if you're paying attention, you actually get to hear Terry actually say, "Cut it out, Shawn." It's one of the great break character spots in wrestling that I've ever seen. Right up there with the one in WrestleMania 22, where if you're watching the casket match between The Undertaker and Mark Henry.
And God bless you if you are.
It's a moment that my good friend Jeremy and I still laugh about constantly to this day. And we're in the overrun. I'm allowed to get off track here.
Yeah.
There's a point where Mark goes through the ropes or over the ropes or something and lands in the casket and just stands there. Doesn't do anything. To the point that you actually hear Undertaker yell at him, "Come on, Mark."
Maybe he was talking to himself and firing himself up.
Which is funny, because when we were watching the match live on pay-per-view, I was sitting there with Jeremy, and when that happened, right at that moment, in my best Fat Albert voice, I just kind of said, "I'm in the casket, what do I do now?" It is, and even as Mark Henry has redeemed himself in recent years, it has still become our running joke. Because
it's a pretty good one.
Up until this past Sunday, that has become our running standard for one of the worst Undertaker WrestleMania matches.
And in fairness to the Undertaker, he competed almost that entire match with apparently a rather severe concussion. And
oh,
Brock Lesnar
yeah.
is no great shakes in the ring.
Well, and you know what? Actually, the really amazing thing about that is a lot of the speculation leading up to this was Brock is notoriously physical and notoriously stiff. Is he really the guy that we want to put in there with a 49-year-old bionic zombie?
It was, yeah. Questionable judgment calls were made.
Yeah, but you know, I'll be damned. It might not have exactly been a flawless execution of a match, but damn it, Brock when needed really stepped up.
Yeah.
He had to step up and carry the whole thing, and God knows the man is neither Ric Flair nor Bret Hart. But all things considered, that
know,
could
think,
have been
I
a
think
lot
Brock
worse.
Is pretty good.
What'd you say?
Haven't you heard ever Brock do the woo? I think he's got a pretty good woo.
No, I've never heard him do it.
I don't know. I hope he has at some point, and I'm just not aware that it's an actual thing.
Oh.
All right, let's get get back on track here to close this thing out. Jigsaw was a great character. One of my favorites, like you said, I maintain the best horror character to come out in the last decade, and I don't feel it's that close of a competition. And Tobin Bell, God bless him, set for life. Was there anything else about the third film I wanted to specifically? Oh, I actually really enjoy the amateur brain surgery sequence, which is an odd thing to say about that, but I really enjoyed that sequence and how it was done. The fact that it actually had a bit of tension to it, and, oh boy, we lost Sean. And since we're in the overrun, he can't call back. Well, I'm sorry for that. I imagine I'll be discussing this with him via Facebook in a couple of moments. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap this thing up solo. I love the first Saw movie. It's one of my favorite horror movies ever. The second, I've mentioned before, logical continuation and escalation. Three, you start seeing the problems that are going to become rampant in the rest of the series. And it's a... But hey, that's 2 weeks from now when we get to rant and rave and piss and moan about the rest of the franchise. And we'll, you know, try to cherish the memories of the good memories that we have of the first three films, because there's so much good there, especially if you're a horror fan. I'm going to go ahead and wrap up and do some plugs here. I just mentioned this, but The Long Road to Ruin will conclude our look at the Saw franchise in 2 weeks. That will be, and no, I can't do math, so I can't do this off the top of my head, the 22nd of April. And I'll be back here hosting. Sean will be back here. And we will tackle Saws 4, 5, 6, and 7. And we will need strength, folks. Your good thoughts and prayers are appreciated while trying to get through some of those. Come back for that. After that, 2 weeks after that, The Long Road to Ruin will continue under my benevolent leadership. And we will start a two-part examination of the Fast and the Furious franchise. And I believe Jed from the Casual Heroes will be joining us for that. So if you like those movies, tune in. We're going to have some fun talking about that franchise as a whole and how it actually redeemed itself. It was on the long road to ruin and made that left turn at Albuquerque that Bugs Bunny missed so frequently and got itself away from... you know, just being schlock, and turned into a pretty darn good franchise, all things considered. All right, so that's kind of what's coming up for us here on The Long Road to Ruin. My column is Locked in the Guillotine. It goes live in the MMA Zone of 411 Mania every Friday. This week I'll be previewing UFC Fight Night 38, I believe. It's Big Nog and Big Country Roy Nelson going at it in the main event. I'll also be talking about news like the fight cards getting shuffled around and Nate Diaz taking his foot and shoving it straight into his mouth once again. All kinds of fun stuff will be had there, and that's going to wrap us. And so if you're into that stuff, check me out there. This week's Everyone Loves a Bad Guy, which is my personal podcast here on the Radlich and Broadcasting Network. It goes live every Friday at 9 p.m. Eastern. I gave Triple H a chance. Those of you who don't know this, going into WrestleMania last week, I made mention that if Triple H became WWE World Heavyweight Champion on that night, or as I later amended, the Raw following WrestleMania, if he walked out with the belts, I would give him his own show, and everyone could call in, and we could rail on Hunter the Barbarian. And he didn't. Daniel Bryan is your WWE World Heavyweight Champion. So Triple H is not going to be discussed at any great length in the immediate future. And my plan right now is I will get in touch with Pat Mullen, who I assume by then will be out of his self-imposed exile because, in his own words, a guy he thinks he could stuff into a locker is now the champion of the world of professional wrestling. And we will continue slogging through comic book villains, and I'll bring him on, and his favorite franchise is Thor, and we will have a look at Thor villains throughout the ages. And that's all that's coming up in my world. Another big, big thank you to Benjamin J. Cologne for our title card. The man outdoes himself every single time. He's over at soulexo.com. That's S-O-U-L-E-X-O, I believe, .com. He's got a just does great work. I think he's going to be at the if you're listening to this in the immediate future, I believe he's going to be at the Asbury Park comic convention in New Jersey. So if you're in the area, stop by, say hi to him, support him. He does great work. And he's actually going to be on an upcoming episode of The Long Road to Ruin. So look forward to that. So big thanks to him. Continue to support him. Continue to support the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network. Subscribe, rate us, comments, criticisms. We welcome it all. Thank you all very much. Again, Sean is disconnected, so I'm going. So for Sean Comer, who has in his Fortress of Seanitude, and I'm Robert Winfrey. I'll see you guys back here in 2 weeks when we examine the very sad legacy of the Saw franchise as it concludes. Where is his outro? I don't have. All right. Can't find the correct outro music. I know there was some cleanup done recently. So I'm signing off with Mark's catchphrase because this is still his show, even if he's at home. And please don't bombard me with "We want Mark" chants in the vein of "We want Flair." He'll be back when he's ready to come back. But I'm stealing this catchphrase because I like it. So I'm Robert Winfrey, and for Sean Comer, this has been The Long Road to Ruin. Be well, be safe, and behave.